A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive.
You know, if you ever look at American politics today and just think, wow, how did it get so complicated? Messy, even with all the constitutional checks and balances. Well, you're definitely in the right place today. We are cracking open a real heavyweight.
Yeah.
James Bryce's huge 1888 analysis, The American Commonwealth.
It really is. Yeah. And, you know, it might sound like some dry, dusty old history book.
Right.
But it's really not. Bryce basically gave us the kind of the real instruction manual for the American political engine.
Not the blueprint.
Exactly. Not the founder's elegant blueprint, but how the engine actually ran day to day back in the late 19th century. So our mission here is to really distill his core question. How does American democracy work? How does it succeed? Often. Well, often in spite of itself. And that key insight, the thing we really want you to take away, is his focus on what he called the unseen forces.
Mm-hmm.
He argued that America's real strengths, maybe its resilience, doesn't just come from the genius decks of the Constitution. It comes from, well, civic culture, its social habits, the way people interact.
And crucially, the power of public opinion, which he saw as just immense.
Yeah, almost terrifyingly pervasive, as he describes it.
Precisely. So if you want a kind of shortcut to understanding, say, why corruption still pops up in state legislatures, or why party loyalty seems to matter more than competence sometimes,
or why certain political ideas just seem impossible to argue against today.
Right. Bryce gives you the vocabulary for that. He saw all these dynamics, these tensions brewing over 130 years ago. It's remarkably relevant.
Okay, so before we dive into the book itself, let's talk about the man, James Bryce. Born 1838, died in 1922. He seems like almost uniquely qualified for this massive undertaking.
Oh, absolutely. He was a genuine powerhouse, a really distinguished British scholar, a jurist, and a pretty seasoned statesman, too. He held this very prestigious position, the Regis Professorship of Civil Law at Oxford. So that gave him a really strong analytical grounding.
But he wasn't just an academic.
Yeah.
Right. That's key here.
No, not at all. And that's what makes his perspective so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
He served in Parliament. He understood the messy reality of politics. And later, he was actually the British ambassador to the United States from 1907 to 1913.
So he had all the scholar's rigor, the politician's practical insight.
Exactly. And maybe most importantly, the detached comparative viewpoint of an outsider, a foreigner looking in.
A critical friend, you could say.
That's a perfect description. He wasn't just reading documents in London. He traveled all over the U.S. He talked to everyone. Presidents, yes, but also, you know, the notorious city bosses like the Tammany Hall guys in New York.
Wow.
He was digging deep. And he wrote as that critical friend, not just cheering, but not simply condemning either. He was trying to understand, to analyze.
Okay, so let's unpack his main argument, his central thesis. He looks at this relatively young American Republic, which was, by many measures, pretty successful, and he asks, why? Why did it work?
Yeah, and his core argument is, well, it's quite elegant, really. He says the American system is this unique and largely successful experiment in self-government. But, and this is the key part, that success flows mainly from the practical habits of the people.
Practical habits.
Yeah, the social customs, the underlying civic culture. It's succeeding not because the theory is perfect, but because of these pragmatic, often quite messy adaptations people made along the way.
So it's like the difference between the architect's beautiful blueprint,
right,
and the actual construction site with all the mud and the shortcuts and the quick fixes needed just to get the building up and make it work.
That's a great analogy. And the book itself mirrors that. It's this epic journey structured like a political map almost.
Encyclopedic, you said earlier.
Totally. He guides you through these different layers. Starts with the big picture, the federal government structure, then zooms into the state governments, which he thought were crucial. Then he gets into the really messy stuff.
The informal forces.
Exactly. The party machinery, the motive forces, as he put it. And finally, he lands on what he saw as the ultimate power, the ultimate sovereign in America, public opinion.
And that distinction he keeps making, the one we need to keep in mind,
yeah,
is that gap between the theory, the beautiful Constitution, and the practice, the often gritty, sometimes ugly reality.
Precisely. He wanted to give people a field guide to the American Republic as it was right then. updating in a way the amazing work Tocqueville had done decades earlier, but for a new, more industrialized, more complex America.
All right, let's get into the structure of the book then. Part one, the national government. He starts with the formal setup, the three branches. But even here, he's looking beyond the text, isn't he?
Oh, definitely. He starts peeling back the layers right away. He looks at the presidency and thinks, okay, this mostly works. It's a strong enough executive, but it's still accountable. But then he gets to Congress, and immediately he sees this tension, the tension between representing all the different voices and actually getting things done efficiently.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Right. And he particularly critiques the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
He saw that the real power wasn't necessarily on the floor, but hidden away in the committee system.
Ah, the committees.
Yeah. Which he felt made policymaking kind of slow, sometimes disjointed, hard to follow.
Okay. But then he moves to the judiciary, the courts. And his tone changes quite a bit, doesn't it? He seems genuinely impressed.
Deeply impressed. He had profound admiration for the Supreme Court, especially the power of judicial review.
The power to strike down laws.
Exactly. He saw that as a uniquely brilliant American invention, a way for the courts to act as a check on what the majority might want at any given moment. He called the Supreme Court the living voice of the Constitution.
The living voice.
Yeah, acting as this crucial, ideally non-political safeguard against the potential excesses of democracy, he saw it as a stroke of genius in the system's design.
Okay, so from the grand federal structure, part two then pulls us down to the state level. And he really insists you can't understand America without understanding the states.
Absolutely crucial. And this is still so true today, isn't it? He points out that the states handle the vast, vast majority of things that affect citizens' everyday lives, you know, schools, roads, police.
Right, the stuff you actually interact with.
Exactly. And this is where he introduces one of his most famous ideas. He called the states laboratories of democracy.
Oh, I love that phrase, laboratories, like places to experiment.
Precisely. Testing grounds for new ideas, new social policies, new political structures. If one state tries something and it fails miserably,
it doesn't take the whole country down with it.
Right. That decentralization provides a kind of resilience. But he wasn't naive about it. He was also pretty critical of the quality of governance he saw in many of those state labs.
How so?
Well, he noted often the mediocre quality of the state legislators themselves, and he saw how vulnerable they were to corruption, to lobbyists, to corporate influence.
Mm.
But he balanced that criticism with real admiration for the underlying American tradition of local self-government, town meetings, local councils. He believed that's where citizens really learn the practical skills of democracy.
Okay, interesting. So next up, part three, the party system. If the government is the skeleton, he sees the parties as, what, the muscles?
Yeah, or maybe the engine room.
Mm.
He describes them as this indispensable but crucially extra-constitutional machinery. They aren't in the Constitution, but they're essential for organizing and channeling political power.
The machinery that makes it all run.
Right. And this is where he gives us that really detailed and, frankly, pretty damning case study. The political boss and the spoil system.
Ah, yes. Tammy Hall comes to mind.
The classic example. Bryce dives into how these incredibly disciplined party organizations maintain their grip. It wasn't just about ideology.
No, it was about practicalities, right?
Yeah.
Patronage.
Exactly. The boss wasn't necessarily making grand speeches. He was trading concrete things, a city job, help with navigating bureaucracy, maybe even basic social services for, say, newly arrived immigrants.
In exchange for what?
For loyalty. For votes. It was a transaction. He described how these machines leveraged corruption, essentially, for both power and sometimes providing actual services to vulnerable people the formal government might ignore.
So it's the dark side of that essential machinery.
It really is. Bryce saw it as a kind of necessary evil. He understood that you needed parties to mobilize voters, to organize across this huge, diverse country. The system probably couldn't function without them.
That's harsh.
The cost was huge. Systematic corruption, he argued. A system where loyalty and just showing up often mattered way more than competence or honesty. So his conclusion was kind of ambivalent. Parties are necessary, but wow, do they cause problems. Corruption, intense partisanship.
Elevating loyalty over actual ability. Okay, so if the party is the machinery, then part four takes us to what he sees as the ultimate power source, public opinion. He calls it the sovereign. This feels like maybe the most profound part of his analysis.
I think it is. It's his deepest insight. Public opinion, he claims, is the true ruler of America. Not the president, not Congress, but the collective will, the general sentiment of the people.
But how does it rule? It doesn't pass laws.
No, not directly. It rules, he says, by creating this pervasive climate of thought, this massive, slow-moving current that shapes what's considered acceptable, what's possible. It makes certain actions or policies basically unthinkable for any politician who wants to get reelected.
Okay, I see that. But he also saw a dark side to this, didn't he? This idea of the fatalism of the multitude.
Yes, that's an incredibly powerful and quite chilling concept.
It sounds like social pressure, almost a kind of tyranny without actual force. But hang on, wasn't the Constitution designed to prevent exactly that? To protect minorities from the tyranny of the majority?
Legally, yes. The Bill of Rights, checks and balances, they're all meant to do that. But Bryce is looking at the social reality. He argues the psychological pressure can be even stronger than legal constraints.
How so?
This fatalism of the multitude is that feeling that resisting the overwhelming majority view is just futile, pointless. Why bother speaking up if everyone else thinks differently? It stifles dissent, discourages independent thought, not through laws, but through this immense social weight. People just conform.
Wow. Okay. That feels very modern.
Doesn't it?
All right. Finally, part V, illustrations. This section has some specific examples, including that really famous chapter, the one people still talk about, Why Great Men Are Not Chosen Presidents.
Yes. It's almost got a bit of wry humor to it, but it's a serious analysis. He didn't just complain about the presidents he saw. He tried to systematically explain why, in his view, truly exceptional individuals often didn't reach the top office.
And he had specific reasons.
He laid out three main ones. First, simple scarcity. Truly great, towering figures are rare in any field, including politics. And he noted that in America, many of the brightest minds were often drawn to business or industry, which were much more lucrative.
Okay. Makes sense. What else?
Second, the mechanics of the political conventions back then. He observed how the process often favored safe candidates. The leading contenders, the big personalities, would often clash and effectively cancel each other out. Leaving room for a dark horse. Someone less known, less controversial, maybe seen as more available or pliable. The compromise candidate.
The safe pair of hands. And his third reason.
The public's preference, especially in relatively calm, prosperous times. He argued that the average voter often preferred leaders who felt relatable, who wouldn't cause too much disruption, rather than, say, a brilliant but perhaps challenging or demanding figure. They wanted someone to manage things, not necessarily to lead a revolution.
Fascinating. Okay, let's pull back from the details and think about the big themes running through the whole book. What are the core messages we should take away?
Well, building on what we just discussed, that first big theme has to be the sovereignty of public opinion.
Right. Everything ultimately bends to it.
Pretty much. All the institutions, the parties, the leaders, they all have to operate within the boundaries set by this slow-moving but immensely powerful popular will, which, you know, explains why politicians today are just obsessed with polling data, social media trends, focus groups.
They're constantly trying to read the current.
Exactly. Because that collective will, even if it's not always perfectly informed, it sets the limits of the possible.
Okay. Theme one. Public opinion rules. What's number two?
Theme two is that crucial gap we talked about. The gap between constitutional theory and political practice.
The blueprint versus the building site again.
Yeah. The Constitution is just the starting point. The real government, the way things actually get done, is shaped by all these informal forces, party machines, entrenched customs, powerful lobbies, media narratives.
So Bryce tells us if a system seems stuck or a policy seems completely illogical, based on the law.
Don't just stare at the legal text. Look deeper. Look at the unwritten rules, the vested interests, the party dynamics, the money involved. That's where the real action often is.
Got it. And a third theme.
I think it's what you might call democratic practicality over theoretical purity.
Meaning
American success, in Bryce's view, didn't come from having a perfectly rational, theoretically pure system. It came from pragmatic solutions, from compromises, from a willingness to kind of muddle through. Think about that complex federal structure, the division of powers, those laboratories of democracy in the state.
It's messy, but it works somehow.
Right. It reminds us that democracy isn't some fixed, perfect endpoint you arrive at. It's an ongoing experiment. Constantly adapting, constantly negotiating between competing values like efficiency versus representation or majority rule versus minority rights. Its strength is in that adaptability, that practicality.
Okay, those are powerful themes. The book is also full of really memorable lines and ideas. Let's maybe highlight a couple.
Definitely. For me, one that always stands out is his description of the states. The state governments are the laboratories in which the new experiments of democracy are constantly being tried.
Yeah, that captures it perfectly. Federalism is a source of innovation, but also a way to contain risk. Brilliant.
What about you?
I think I lean towards his core methodological challenge, his advice to us, really. Something like, the best way to understand American institutions is to observe them in operation rather than to study their constitutional description.
Look at what people do, not just what the documents say.
Exactly. Look at the behavior, the reality on the ground, not just the glossy brochure.
And we absolutely have to come back to that warning about public opinion, that idea of the fatalism of the multitude.
A dismissal of the duty of resistance to spoken wisdom.
Right. It's such a chilling phrase. The idea that the sheer weight of the majority, even if it's a silent majority, can just crush dissent and make people afraid to think for themselves.
Okay, so bringing this very old book into our world today, how can we actually use Bryce's insights? What are some real life applications?
Well, one practical tip is to consciously use his lens when you're analyzing political situations. You see some bizarre policy outcome or some decision that just doesn't seem to make sense on the surface.
Yeah.
Ask yourself, is this the result of the formal government structures laid out in the law? Or is it the product of that other government, the extra constitutional machinery, the lobbyists, the party insiders, the media shaping the narrative? Distinguishing between those two can be really revealing.
That's a great analytical tool. What else?
Think about civic education. Bryce kind of implies that true understanding, the real skills of self-governance, don't just come from reading textbooks about how government should work.
Where do they come from then?
From doing it. From participating directly in your local community, getting involved in the town council, the school board, local volunteer groups. That's where you learn the practical, often messy art of democracy firsthand.
Learn by doing. Makes sense. And maybe one more, that mediocrity argument about presidents.
Right. Apply that thinking more broadly. When you're evaluating any political candidate, don't just look at their charisma or their policy position.
What's the system that produced them?
Exactly. Ask, is the party primary system or the campaign finance system actually designed to promote the safest, the least offensive, maybe the most easily managed candidate, rather than necessarily the most brilliant or the most experienced or the leader the country might actually need at that moment? Look at the process, not just the person.
That adds a whole other layer to how you might assess candidates.
Okay.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one thing that really stands out for you? What surprised you, or what did you find most resonant?
For me, it's that constant tension Bryce reveals, particularly around the party system. He shows so clearly how it was both absolutely essential for making democracy work on a large scale, mobilizing voters, organizing action, and at the same time, how it was almost inherently corrupting, how it fostered this culture of patronage and loyalty over merit. It's this fundamental contradiction baked right into the practical workings of the system.
Yeah.
And it just underscores his broader point. The laws, the Constitution, they're just the framework. Ultimately, American democracy depends on the character, the habits, the engagement or lack thereof of its actual citizens, flaws and all.
I completely agree. What I loved, or maybe appreciated, was how he forces you to shift perspective constantly. You see the genius of the Constitution, yes, but not as some perfect theoretical document. Its genius lies in its resilience, its ability to somehow absorb and adapt to all these messy, unseen forces he describes, the parties, the bosses, the swirling public opinion.
It's built for humans, not angels.
Exactly. It's designed, maybe unintentionally, for the reality of imperfect people trying to govern themselves.
So maybe the final thought I'd leave you with is this. Bryce's enduring insight is that democracy isn't a machine that just runs itself. It needs constant attention, constant cultivation. You can't just set it up and take it for granted. Its resilience is real, he shows that. But so are its vulnerabilities. And the challenge for every single generation is maintaining that difficult balance, that constant tension between encouraging broad popular participation, which is essential, and simultaneously protecting against that potential fatalism of the multitude, that tyranny of the majority. It's a job, as Bryce implies, that's really never finished.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.